Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
HQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Oh, Mr. Sulu, you're going to be so surprised tonight and so excited. Good evening and welcome one more fabulous time to Madame Perry's Salon. All you hep cats, hep kittens, swingers, and I'm just so happy to have you here once again. I want to thank you so much for supporting and being followers on iTunes and Stitcher and everywhere because you follow and I bring you, well, Madame Perry knows the most fabulous people in the world. So don't know how, it happens like magic. But again, because this is Madame Perry, also known as Jennifer Perry. And if you've been listening to lately, don't forget, you know, we had Rudy Sarzo on a couple months ago. He's, you may know him as a bass player for Quiet Riot or the Blizzard of Oz. And also he and Chasm Sultan, who was on, you know, they trade off doing bass for Blue Oyster Cult. But Rudy Sarzo and his wife are very avid animal activists in Los Angeles. And his book, Off the Rails, My Life with Sharon and Ozzy, Touring with Ozzy, that's a good book. I highly recommend that. And if you heard him on here, tell him. But you can still download the show. But yeah, but check out, get his book. And also, as I was mentioning, Chasm Sultan, you probably know him beginning from Todd Rundgren, Utopia, that he's also played with Joan Jett, Celine Dion, Meatloaf, just about everybody. And he's got a solo, as he was telling us when he was on the show a few weeks ago, Chasm Sultan has a solo CD, a new solo one actually, called Bootleg. And he would love for you to get that. He's actually selling some of his equipment too right now. So if you're enough of a fan to where you want to buy his bass, he would love to sell it to you. And so, yeah, definitely get that. Also, coming up soon, we got the Twang Bar King. If you know from King Crimson and you know from his own group, Adrian Ballou. Also, we had Greg Dybeck, and that show's getting a lot of downloads lately. Greg Dybeck, he's a managing editor of Elite Daily, and his book is called The Art of Living Other People's Lives. You know, people still, when I see him, they still quote some of his lines from the show because he was so funny. So, yeah, if you don't read Elite Daily, check it out. It's an online magazine, and Greg Dybeck, book is good. He is a riot. He's a hilarious guy. So let me tell you, I am so psyched about tonight's guest. You've probably seen it on all my social media. She's a Canadian American actress, comedian, and actually she started doing stand-up comedy. You may be surprised to know, as I was, even back when she was still in high school. She's an author and an activist for several charitable organizations, including AIDS Awareness and Child Abuse. And I am so delighted to invite into Madame Perry's Salon. It's her first time here in the Genie's Bottle, so please be warm and welcoming to Allison Arngrim. Allison, welcome to Madame Perry's Salon.
Hi, thank you.
Hello. I am so happy to have you here. I don't know if Harlan told you it looked like the inside of a genie's bottle in here, but or if he mentioned that.
No,
so just on the nice fluffy cushion and get comfortable.
Okay, good. Got it.
Yeah, good. Like this little Moroccan decor. I didn't recognize it at first, but one of my first guests said, went on social media afterwards and said, it looks like the inside of Jeannie's bottle in there. So it's stuck in this. If I could guess, yeah, it just does. So we're so happy to have you. You know, so many people know you when you became, even though you had been acting before as a child, when you became the infamous Nellie Olson on Little House on the Prairie. And, you know, I don't think you would be surprised to hear me say people still watch it every day.
It is. It's in 140 countries, if you can imagine such a thing. And I meet people from absolutely all over the world, and they're all watching it.
All the time. I mean, everybody, it's not like you have to say, like there are some people when you go, like I'll have somebody go, well, you know, that we're in this band, they had this song, the whatever, and they'll go, not ringing the bell. And you go, well, Allison, oh my God, I watch that every day when I get home from work.
Right, right. Yeah, somebody, yeah, you have to explain who it is, but you go, Nellie Olson, they go, what? It's like, oh, her. It's immediate. Yes, Little House on the Prairie, Nellie Olson. Yeah.
And
everyone either watches it or their girlfriend or their mom watches it. Someone says, oh, yes, Little House. And people have heard, they'll say, oh, I never watch it, but I've totally heard of it. And then they'll go home and tell their boyfriend or their girlfriend or mother, and they'll go, oh, my God, you met Nellie Olson.
And somebody was telling me, and I was going to go, well, you watch it too, didn't you? I go, well, yeah, like people are not, you know, trusting me. You know, it's like
you did watch it, didn't you? Are you a member of our weird cult? Are you not? Yes.
I mean, I'm getting used to the thing. Are you a red state or a blue state person? But I wasn't expecting this, Allison, that people would be, you know, wanting to verify. You want to see my card, my voting card? Am I an Allison Arngren fan? Yes. Did I watch Nellie? Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I love your book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. Oh my gosh.
Oh, what? Thank you. It's you know, as I say, something for everyone in it.
Oh, yes. You've got some things. Some of the lines will go, since my book is an e-book and you can't just mark it off and put little tags in, I went through writing little things. Like, I got to write this down and remember it because I don't know how to tag it or whatever on an e-book
right.
on a Kindle. But right now, first I got to say, if you're listening live tonight, and I believe a lot of people are, you can call in and say hello to Allison and talk to her. Ask a question. Tell her you love her. The number is 646-716-9922. Blog Talk Radio assures me that it is toll-free in the continental U.S. And I think, Allison, we have a call from Louisiana.
Oh, Louisiana. Wonderful.
Hey, welcome to Madame Perry Salon with Allison Arngren.
Hey, Jennifer, it's Carrie Dunn.
Hey, Carrie Dunn, my favorite neo-noir author. Calling from New Orleans?
Yep, I am. How are you doing, Allison? Can I call you Allison? I feel like I grew
up
with you.
Yes, you may. And you know, I have not been to New Orleans, and I really, really, really want to go to New Orleans, and I have not been. Shame on me.
You haven't completed anything until you come to New Orleans.
I know, right? Yeah. I am deprived.
I just want to say I grew up with seven sisters, so of course they watched Little House on the Prairie, and I would act mad because we only had one television. And I wanted to watch something, you know, boys would watch, Knight Rider or something. But anyway, so of course I ended up watching it, you know, and getting hooked on it and everything. And when I saw that Jennifer was having you on the show, I was thinking about that. You were kind of like our generation's Eddie Haskell. From Leave It to Beaver. But what was so good about your performance, because, I mean, people, I think, love to hate you, or at least, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Kids.
Mm-hmm.
But you were a good little actress. You had you were able to, I mean, I didn't recognize it at the time, of course, because I was like 6, 7, 8 years old, but you had a certain empathy that made you not just hate the character, but also to, you know, kind of feel sorry for him or feel some kind of guilt for hating them so much. So.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And, you know, it's funny because I know Ken Osmond. I've been at several events with Ken Osmond at autograph shows and things. And we actually took
a
poll
once
at a Speedy Land convention. Hmm? Pardon?
Is he a cop in L.A.?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, he he went and joined the police, which is kind of hilarious that Eddie Haskell became a cop. But he, we took a poll of the whole TV Land audience. We tried to decide, like, which one of us was worse. I won. We was really close. Who has hated more, Eddie Haskell or Nellie Olson? But, yeah, that's the thing. I do get that from people all over, and especially, like, from the French. Nellie Olson, but she's the poor child without the smile. And there is this weird connection to Nellie Olson that people, they hate her, but they enjoy, they keep tuning in again and again, going, and now I need to hate her some more.
Yeah, because it wasn't like, say, J.R. Ewing or something where you just hated him completely.
Well, you just hated him.
Yeah, but, I mean, you had something else going there a little bit. That, you know, I can't imagine
and
being
think,
your age
you know,
at that time, and I imagine people in real life would probably shout things at you on the street.
It literally, yeah. Well, you know who had that also is Kathy McGregor, the actress who played Mrs. Olsen, my evil mother on the show. She had that going, too, is just when you wanted to smack her upside the head, she was so awful, she had this over-the-top sort of foolishness where you just went, oh, my God, this woman does not know what she's doing. And every now and then she'd break down and confess everything to Carol. Oh, the poor thing. And so people, they wanted to see Mrs. Olsen again, even though she was the most obnoxious person ever. But yet people took it as if it were real. I mean, I was in the Christmas parade on Hollywood Boulevard. They have the big Hollywood Lane Christmas parade, and I was about 16. And someone threw a McDonald's cup of orange soda at my head.
Good
I was
Lord.
Kind of impressed because it was a moving target. The car was moving, and they got me right in the side of the face. But people really took it literally. And I even had a woman not that long, just a few years ago, come up to me, a grown person at an autograph show, grown woman, walk up to me and just start to freak out. And she didn't say hello. She didn't say good morning. She actually said, I forgive you, and walked out. I'm a grown person. This is not a kid. So, yeah, there were people where it made such an impression. It just, it was real to them.
It's like, what do you say? But then talking about real, and I like that story was that, Carrie, you've got to get her book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, Alison Arngrim, because it started, and I think that was the opening. That was the opening scene in the book, was at this county fair when that happened, you
right.
know, and I can see the dude, I can just see her pulling herself out, breathing in, and her face all twisted up, and she's just about to bust with this. And,
I thought smoke was going to come out her ears. I did, I swear. And my husband was right there. We're both sitting there. We thought, well, this will be fun. We'll do this autograph show. And this woman just came, and she was just steam, smoke, flipping out. And then, I forgive you. And we're just like, wow, she was holding. How long was this woman holding this in?
She felt like she was going to go back to her prayer meeting and say, you know.
Yeah, right.
Instead of having to
forgive
about
Nellie
it.
Olson. What kind of points do you get for that?
I love you from your sins. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you. I'm sorry I do have to go, but I'll be listening in the rest of the day.
Well,
but
nice
talking to you.
Say hi to everyone in New Orleans. Tell them I hope to visit
soon. I will.
Soon.
You should.
All right,
thank
thanks,
you so much for
Carrie.
Taking time to talk to me. Bye, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Okay, later.
Goodbye, sweetie. All right. And then we have somebody else here for you. Allison, I hope you're prepared. I think you're going to have a lot of callers tonight. And this is one from Atlanta. Hi, welcome
it's
to Madam Carrie.
Oh, floor. Another fabulous place. I've been to Atlanta. A gorgeous place.
Hi.
Hello.
I think I know that sound. Is this Vince?
This is Vince Bryant.
Oh, hey. Oh, you know these people. Hi.
Hey, listen, I've got some regulars. I've got a lot. Because one time, I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Very good,
remember,
very good.
Remember the punk band?
We only call in when it's interesting.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you.
Well, I'll try to make
you're
it all
welcome.
Interesting. But, Allison, you're very special. You know, it took me 3 years to get the nerve to ask you to be on the show, so you know.
Really? I'm sitting right here. I would have been happy to be on it.
It was so fun. I got to tell you this. And Vincent's a filmmaker and a musician from New York, so he's going to understand this story. And I thought, your publicist is so parlous, or the manager publicist, he is so funny.
Oh, isn't he darling? Do you love him?
He is. The first time he called me, and I was on the air, so I didn't answer, so I called back. And I saw the message. I said, I'm sorry I didn't answer. I was on the air. He said, and that's your excuse?
That's Harlan.
And, okay, I know this. I said, well, it's all I got right now. I'm sorry. He is, and from then on, it was. I thought, okay, I know. He's cool. Good. But Vincent, musician, filmmaker here in Atlanta, and Vincent, Allison Arkham, can you believe it? She's right here in Madame Perry's Salon.
I believe it.
Hey, are you calling from the gym or something?
No,
yeah,
I'm ducked into a Starbucks. I'm in a Starbucks. And it sounds hollow because I'm the only one in here.
Oh,
I am,
yeah, because I hear all these weird noises back there. I go, is it the supermarket?
Yeah.
Is it the gym? I don't know. Where is that place?
No. And you know what's funny?
Is that the steamer for the cappuccino or something?
No, it's a little worse than that. It's the Peachtree Center one. So they close in 15
minutes. I know where that is. The Peachtree Center.
Yes,
yes. I know where you are.
Listen to this wonderful ambient sound. Now I'm outside of the Starbucks.
Ah.
Yeah. But that's enough about that. I want to hear more about this book.
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
About my book,
you Prairie Bitch.
Yeah,
yes, Confessions
book.
Of a Prairie Bitch. It's on Amazon and all that jazz and stores and what have you. And you can get it in hardcover and softcover and Kindle. You can also get it in French. I made a French publishing deal. So if you want to sit around and read it in French, you can.
Okay.
But, yeah, it came out. Actually was released in 2010, paperback in 2011, and people really like it. I have gotten a really great response. I wrote it really in response to all the questions, because all these years of having been in a little house, people kept asking me the same questions over and over and over again. I thought, well, what if I answered them? What if I said, all right, this is what you want to know. I am finally going to answer all of your questions. And I started doing this one-woman show, which was all about answering questions, had a whole Q&A thing, and it was really a hit. And while I was doing that, I was kind of writing the long version of the book, and a literary agent came and saw my show in New York, where I was performing at the Laurie Beachman, and it said, you know, is there a show to go with this book? And indeed there was. Is there a book to go with the show? Usually people do the book and then the show. I did the show then the book. And we started talking, and I sent him what I had written, my chapters, and he said, yeah, we've got a book here. And so I really did put in, as I say, everything and the kitchen sink, I think. And people have responded accordingly. People have been really happy with it.
Wow.
That's
fantastic.
And, you know, I've seen some videos of your stand-up show, but I understand from your book, too, that you said Michael Landon knew that you talked about him on the show, and, you know, and he loved it.
Absolutely. Michael Landon had a great sense of humor, and he knew that in my stand-up act, people asked him that I made wisecracks about him and talked about him and everything, and he thought it was hilarious. And so he completely knew, and he wasn't the kind of person who was, like, thrilled to be mentioned in my act and thought it was funny as anything.
Wow.
Okay.
I can imagine he had a great sense of humor, because that guy
was such a... Yeah, well, if you watch the show, you know, it is there. It's like so many TV shows, they'll have a Christmas episode. I think Little House was one of the few shows that regularly had a Halloween episode, because Michael loved practical jokes. And, of course, remember, his first big break... even before Bonanza, was when he was in the movie I Was a Teenage Werewolf. So he loved werewolves and horror movies.
Yep.
I mean, he was into all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you even had a section where you talk about, there's so many shows that had as callbacks or mentions Little House on the Prairie, I think. Wasn't there a Mystery Science Theater 3000 showing that had a I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon and had had a call back to you?
Yes, I was so proud. I was watching Mystery Science Theater 3000, which I always thought was hilarious, and they were showing I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, and I thought, well, this should be good. And they're, you know, commenting on everything. And at one point, Michael's character, he's, you know, smashing up the lab, and he's like, this is terrible. No, I got to get turned back into human. He's very upset about the whole thing. And they're commenting, and one of them finally says, I think Nellie Olson's behind all of this. And I was just so proud that I got a mention. I got a shout out on Mystery Science Theater 3000. I had one of the best days of my life.
Vince, if you could scoot over just a little bit. I've got somebody else that's coming here into Madame Perry's salon. If you don't mind.
I'm scooting over.
Scoot on over. I love that. That's good.
Welcome to Madame Perry's Salon. You're here with Jennifer Perry and Allison Arngrim and Vince Sleevey Bryant. Just come on and introduce yourself.
They're shy. Hello.
Don't be shy.
Oh, hi.
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 Hi there. Hi. Hi, Madame Perry. Rick Cornell again from Reno, Nevada.
We've got everybody. Let's see. We've had what? We had Louisiana and New York and wow, this is great.
Yeah, your fame is getting spread throughout the country. Is that cooler?
I guess he's an attorney in Reno. I might as well go ahead and spill the dirt first. He's an attorney in Reno.
Oh.
However, he's also a thriller writer, and his hobby is singing with the opera group. But last time I had him in here once with another thriller writer, suspense writer, and one of them, they keep blaming it on the other, left a burrito with a cushion. Now, I've had a clean house, but I just want you to know I've got a bad house. Okay, Rick Cornell.
Well, good
go
to
ahead.
Know an attorney in Reno. It sounds like that's a good person to know. I should keep your number handy.
Well,
I
suppose. I mean, my advertising byline is: if you find yourself in the Florence McClure Women's Correctional Center and you still have money, call me. Maybe not. Well,
okay.
I mean, OJ is 90 miles. East of here, and whether he has money or not is one of those state secrets that's right up there with how much gold is in Fort Knox, you know. So what I can say is he hasn't called me.
Darn.
Yeah, oh well. but I was going to ask you, if you didn't mind, it would seem to me that in being a writer, particularly if you're writing fiction, the difficulty that you might face as an actor or actress would be sort of similar to the difficulty I would face as an attorney or an opera singer, which is that you're used to a medium where you have to be succinct. I mean, in the case of acting, the show is going to be however many minutes long it's going to be, and you're going to be remembered by the catchy one-line dialogue phrases that are given to you. And with opera, you know, it's kind of the same thing. The show's going to be 2.5 hours long. I mean, there are longer operas than that, but the small company I was in with the cost of producing an opera simply couldn't do a Wagner opera, much less a Ring cycle. So You're doing an opera that's 2.5 hours long, where the plot is going to whip through at lightning speed. And as an appellate lawyer, it's kind of the same thing, you know, right to your audience, which is a bunch of old tired judges who have eye strain and they don't want to read a whole lot more than they absolutely have to. And when you foray into writing, it's kind of a different skill set. You know, you can't tell the story, you have to show the story, you have to give them detail that you might not otherwise have.
Right, well, for actors, too, especially
in television.
Or a play
or a movie or whatever, so,
right.
I don't know.
Especially an actor, especially a child actor, I mean, yeah, you're constrained, you're told what to say, this is what we're doing. We're doing Little House on the Prairie, and the show is about this, and this is what this episode is about, and this is what you're going to be saying, the end. You know, there's not a lot of room for improv. They might let you change a line here and there, but that's really it, because they go, this is what we're shooting. But, yeah, when it's your book, it's your book. You can talk about whatever you want. And absolutely, and then it's also on you to provide the detail. You don't have a director standing there, you know, saying, okay, well, you know, do it this way, or, well, if you're having trouble with a scene, have you tried this? You're on your own. You need to create the whole scenario. And, of course, I kind of enjoyed that because I was doing stand-up comedy for many, many years before this. And with stand-up, that was a real jump for someone who was raised in absolutely in television, where it was very restricted. This is what we're doing. This is what we're saying. You have all these other people in the show with you. You're an ensemble cast. to suddenly be alone doing a one-woman show, only person on the stage, I'm writing it, I'm directing it, I'm creating it, I'm in it, I'm the only one up there, that's like night and day. So I'd already gone through that, and that was quite the shock. And so then in writing the book, it was just sort of the ultimate extension of that,
Yeah, and I would think, right, ultimate extension. I would think even more so because even as a stand-up comedian, if you're on a show, you're starting with somebody else or you're headlining, you're still being given a very finite amount of time.
Right,
and,
eventually, you know.
And
even,
you're going to last
have
about
an hour
as long
and a half,
as your first
still,
bomb
done
joke,
after.
I guess. I don't know. So, yeah, it's tough. People say, well, you know, that's an easy transition, and I think we're saying, no, not as easy as all that.
It is. It's very, and that's why a lot of actors who go to write books, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Some people, they have a knack for that. That's in their personality, that when they go to write a book, they have something to say, and it works. It's in their personality to tell a story, and it comes out great. And then there's other times celebrities go to write a book, and they're just stuck. There's just nothing there. They can't hack it, and that's when they have to call in the ghostwriters and you know, do the as book as told to, because they're just you know, hung out to dry.
And when the ghostwriter can't even help them, then we really got troubles, right?
And I actually met someone who told me, they said they didn't mind when they interviewed the celebrity and it was as told to, but when they had the celebrity where they wouldn't even get on the phone with them, they're like, just here's my bio and some press clippings, go make it up. They're like, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. They like, you have to at least be willing to make a phone call, for God's sakes.
Oh boy. Well, they don't call it art for a reason. Anyway.
All right.
And you're right. You know, just, it's, I don't know, being an appellate lawyer, doing stand-up, to me, they both have about the same fear. I've done stand-up. I've never been a lawyer, although I worked at a law office once before a state court solicitor and got called on the stand by a lawyer to try to win a case on whether or not I filed a motion in a timely manner, and that was pretty terrifying. But I imagine they both have the same kind of thing. You're up there, you know, it's you. You don't have a backup group or backup musicians to cover or another actor to remember a line if you forgot or something. It is just you.
You've got to connect with your audience, as it were. You have to connect with them and get them on your side, as just as you would need to get them on your side in a nightclub, except it might be a matter of life and death in the case of the courtroom. But it's the same thing. If you don't connect with the people you're talking to, you're finished.
Yeah. I think it's probably true of any art that involves public speaking. The advantage is that you have them in your hand. You have them in the palm of your hand for about 15 seconds, and you better make them count.
That's it.
You know,
that
I think that's
it.
Why so many people are terrified of doing that, anything
that
involves public.
And why so many attorneys do to wind up taking drama classes and studying acting.
Oh, yeah.
Very necessary.
Drama and public speaking both.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, Allison, I know you were acting. You did, you know, commercials, and I think you did a movie before Little House. But you said in high school you were doing stand-up. I mean, that's...
Indeed. I started working when I got my SAG card when I was 5. I started working when I was a little girl doing commercials and TV appearances. I did a movie when I was 10. And then, I was on the show, and everybody wanted to have something to do besides the show. And you know, traditionally, especially in the 70s, you're on a television show, you sing and become, you know, a pop star on the side. Or many of the people who actually couldn't sing but still became a pop star on the side. But I that wasn't my thing at all. And so I did hang out with a lot of stand-up comedians. My father was a manager, was managing a lot of comics, so I was at the clubs a lot. And so comedy, I seemed to relate more to that. And so I wound up starting doing stand-up comedy when I was 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
And by the time I was 16, I was like 4 nights a week, every week at the clubs in L.A.
Huh.
Now, how old was the audience, average? Or range.
Oh, well, it was a nightclub. It was over 21. I had to wait in the parking lot until it was time to do my set and come on, because I legally couldn't be in the club. No, these were grown people at the Comedy Store and the Improv, and yeah.
I guess when you're 15 years old under those circumstances, you grow up awfully quickly. Because it's difficult
and
for me to...
growing up in Hollywood, too. I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
In a showbiz family, absolutely. Everyone knew was in showbiz. So, yeah, there was a...
Otherwise, it's difficult for me to imagine a 15-year-old doing stand-up and reaching an audience of adults like that. It seems like that'd be awfully difficult, but... You did it.
But indeed, but you know, and there's a lot of people. There were actually, there's been a couple of comics who did start really young, and you know, they all started like, but more like 18, 19, but even then. But that's the thing. I mean, I had been working a full time job since I was 12 and supporting myself and you know, had traveled for the show and been on the road and had been getting interviewed by magazines and press for years and years and years and been on talk shows. So I'd already done an awful lot of things by 15 that really the average 15-year-old hadn't done.
Yeah.
One thing I wondered if, because thinking, like I said, thinking about you that young where you have to wait outside to go in because of the 21, you're so young. But then again, you were working around people and not just in the work part, in the periphery parts of acting on Little House with a lot of adults who were very funny people, like the makeup people, Gladys, and then, oh my gosh, Whitey Snyder, who did Marilyn Monroe. As soon as I saw that
name,
I was
like,
oh my God.
Right, the old makeup artists, real old Hollywood. And that's the thing, too, is that, you know, I was working with adults since I was 6 years old on film sets, and I, as I said, been interviewed, and I'd been interviewed on talk shows. There was a show when I was a little kid. It was called Juvenile Jury, and it was like this panel talk show for children, and I was on that. So... And my father, as I said, was a manager, so I was working with professional comedians. My first stand-up act, I met with a team of writers. It was a comedy group. They were called the Village Idiots, a great group of people. And, in fact, they all went on to be quite famous. One of the Village Idiots was the actor Peter Jurasik, who was later on Babylon 5 and a bunch of shows. Jan Fisher, who later wrote the movie The Lost Boys. Mark Anzell, who was one of the producers of the TV show Coach. And so they were all people who went on to fairly big fame in writing and comedy. And they were the ones who sat down with me and said, okay, how do you write a stand-up act? What does a 15-and-a-half-year-old say? What are your topics? What are you going to talk about that you would relate to as a teenager, but that is also a topic that adults know about and that is something that would relate to them? How do we bridge this gap? What's the translation between your life and their life? So it was very professionally put together.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. I mean, that must have been difficult. Difficult for the writers as well as for you, I would think.
Right. They were like, okay, is this something? They said, okay, so people remember when they were teenagers, but obviously it's extremely different in, you know, 1978 to be a teenager than it was when they were. So what's going on in your world? And then you're an actor, and you're not a regular teenager. You're on TV, and you're doing, so what does that mean, and how do we talk about that? And so, and how do you, you know, perceive things from where you are. So it made it really interesting. So it actually was a hell of an act for a 15-year-old. And that got me going. And I mean, my basic, you know, I had a sense of humor. I basically found things to be funny, which was why stand-up was better for me than other venues I might have taken on. But then with people who actually, you know, knew what they were doing, sitting down with me and going, okay, if we were going to talk about this, how would we talk about that? How would we do that? And so I wound up with really a very, very good professionally done stand-up act.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, back to when I was 15, what was I thinking about? Well, chasing girls, what else? How are you going to talk about chasing Michael Landon, right?
Right, but that's, of course,
isn't
the audience
work
when you think about
quite
how much
so well,
the crush they all had on him. So, yeah, talking about chasing Michael Landon, exactly.
Yeah.
So tell me, after, you know, Michael Landon, like you talked, and I've read this other places, how, you know, he would wear those And in the 70s, yeah, I remember people did go. It was cool to go commando under your jeans, but he
this
would go
true,
commando under his prairie pants.
Well, you watch
and,
the show. I mean, you can watch it now, and you see. I mean, that's the thing. We knew, Michael knew, and the producer knew that our biggest viewership were women 40 plus. So he knew all the women were tuning in to look at hot little Joe. And so, indeed, you watch the show even now. You can see he's not wearing underwear. The man is not wearing underwear. It's the 1800s, and he's in skin-tight pants with no underwear. He knew who was tuning in.
So we're saying he was a crowd pleaser. He was a people pleaser.
Exactly. He was a real believer in give the people what they want.
Well, at least let them look at it and think about it, you know. But at least, yeah, always like stripped down to his waist and his bare chest.
Yeah, Paul
and,
was always taking off his shirt, you know. And then if you think about it, in reality, in the 1800s, people were relatively modest, and even on the farm, yeah, probably would have put his shirt on when Doc Baker or someone rolled up in the wagon and said, "Oh, excuse me, here, let me get dressed." But no, he was constantly shirtless.
Oh, okay. Yeah. See, that's right. He wasn't a stingy man. He believed in giving to his audience, and I just think that's wonderful.
I give
that's
and a... give and give, exactly.
Give.
On my phone.
And I would think, too, though, that having your but still, even though a performer and a comedian having great professional writers work with, still, though, I think that's that kind of snappy dialogue, though. Like you talk about Gladys, the makeup, the hairdresser.
Oh, my God.
And
yeah, the people I met and the people I grew up around. Exactly. These were the people who had been the hairdressers and makeup artists to Marilyn, to Joan Crawford, to Betty Davis, to, you know, Faye Dunaway, to all of these people. And they told these stories about them. And so these were the kind of people I grew up with, these just incredible people. And the things I saw and the people I met growing up as a kid in Hollywood and my family. I mean, my father worked at Seymour Heller and Associates, so he managed Liberace. That was Seymour Heller, who worked, you know, Liberace's right-hand man. And so I went and saw Liberace's shows as a child, and he worked with Debbie Reynolds and all these famous people. And so, I was experiencing things and exposed to things and meeting people that were very, very not boring. So, yeah, it was a little more exciting than some 15-year-olds.
Rick, sweetie, if you could just move over a minute. Somebody else has come here into Madame Perry's
salon. Everybody scoot down the couch.
Oh, certainly.
Right.
Scoot down the couch. And I think Vincent left us to go get some more coffee. He may drop back in. He may.
Okay.
Welcome. And I know who this is because this is it's my BFF, Kenya Colbert. Kenya, come
hello.
On in, Madame Perry. Rick, here. Allison Arngrim.
Hello. How is everybody tonight?
Very good, thank you.
Doing well.
Hi, guys. I'm just dipping in, but I tell you, I have been a fan for so long. This is no joke. Jennifer will tell you. I'm always a fan, so I was so happy that she said you were coming on tonight. And then I got pulled to the side, and I was like, no, I got to get in there. So happy I caught you.
Well,
thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. So, guys, continue on. Just let me just kind of catch up with where you are. I just had to get that out. I'm sorry. Sorry, Jennifer.
Well, we're just rambling on about Michael Landon and stand-up comedy in the 1970s and life in general. This is fun because, you know, I feel like I'm at a cocktail party with a bunch of fans of the show. It's kind of good. And we got people from every state. Where are you calling in from? Where are you?
I'm in Georgia as well. I'm in Georgia.
Oh,
so.
Great.
That Southern Gaul. Did I lose you guys?
Everybody's still there, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's just us.
I'm here, Madam Perry. I'm in the process of multitasking. But anyway, yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was
what
kicked
we do,
out for
right?
a moment. I was kicked out for a moment, but I'm back now, and I hope everyone is still here.
That's funny, Will. I did a show a couple weeks ago with Robbie Rist, who was on the Brady Bunch, you know, Cousin Oliver. And it was funny because he had technical difficulties, and he wasn't able to call into the show. And so I did the show with his co-host and his tech guy, and it was hilarious because we said, okay, we're doing the Robbie Riss show. Robbie's not here, but we're just going to carry on without him. And we went on. We did like 10, 20 minutes without the host of the show. It was a scream.
Wow. So you were saying when I came in, I'm sorry, I was listening to the whole Liberace and all the great people you were introduced to as a 15-year-old. I'm impressive. So let me ask you, and I'm only asking this because I missed the beginning part. What age did you come into the, wasn't that about that time, maybe 14, 15 years old, onto Little House on the Prairie?
Little House, I was just turning 12 when I got Little House. I've been working since about 5, 6 years old, and I was in junior high. I was 12 years old when I got Little House on the Prairie, and then I've been on the show for several years and was looking for like other things to do, and that's why I started doing a stand-up comedy at like 15 and a half. And as I said, it went on and on through my teens, and then by the time I got to be like 19 and 20, I started touring, and it was crazy because I knew so many people, the other comics and people who I knew because growing up in Hollywood, my dad being a manager, like you're familiar with the Laugh Factory in Hollywood, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, Jamie Masada, who started the Laugh Factory, I've known him since I was 10 years old. So I remember when he started, he said, hey, I think I'm opening a club. You should come by. You know, it's like when it was like it seated 8 people, you know. So I was there at the beginning of a lot of this kind of stuff and actually involved with all the people in the, you know, making of, as it were. There's a book out, and it's about stand-up comedy and the Comedy Store and all this stuff and what was going on in the mid to late 70s and early 80s. And it's called I'm Dying Up Here. And it's the story of stand-up comedy in the 70s. And I'm in it. I was interviewed for the book. I have like a couple of pages. I have like 2 photos in it. And it was amazing because even though as a teenager, I was part of that whole era when stand-up comedy really, really blew up in the 70s. It became sort of the rock and roll for, you know, as I said, stand-up comedy is rock and roll for people who can't sing. And, you know, in the 60s was a whole movement in music, and then it was in the 70s when stand-up comedy really kind of became, you know, the rock and roll of its day.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree with that.
And I got to be a whole part of that beginning scene, which is really amazing. I look back on that and go, oh, my God, all of that stuff, all of those people, when Jay Leno was just starting out and David Letterman and Robin Williams, and I was there. I'm there in the parking lot with these people and opening for them and on the same stage. It was kind of amazing.
Yeah. Hey, Allison, let me ask you a question, if I may. being a non-Hollywood guy, I mean, I hear the stories of Gary Coleman and Todd Bridges and Plato and these kind of people. But obviously your reality was not theirs. If a parent were to come to you today and say, I have a 10-year-old child and I want my child to become a Hollywood actress or actor or something like that, what would you tell them? What advice would you give?
I generally do discourage it because a lot of people, when they say that, you know, if they say my child wants to act as opposed to be a TV star, wants to act or wants to sing or wants to, I say, oh, by all means. I mean, there's no matter how small a town you live in, there's a community theater, there's some kind of acting class at the school, there's some kind of venue where you can do stuff. Sign them up for classes, put them in the local theater, put them in plays. Or, you know, I was just down in Pinehurst, North Carolina, and they said it was difficult to find theater venues, but I met a young girl, she's about 12. She said, well, I started my own YouTube channel, so my friends and I are doing scenes. Start your own YouTube channel, kid. There's things that they can be doing in a safe space, in a sensible environment, an educational environment for a young kid, where they can act, they can express themselves. You know, you don't want to thwart anyone creatively. The kid says, I really, really like acting and singing dance. You don't want to say, no, go to your room, you're going to be a plumber. You have to, you know, allow them to express themselves. But a person can act or sing or dance or express themselves creatively and not necessarily become part of the Hollywood machinery. Whereas the publicity and the agents and the managers and the thing, you don't necessarily have to inflict that on your kid. They can still act. So if they just want to perform, by all means, perform away. But when they say, but I want to go into show business, I generally discourage it because it is very tough. It's a business. It's a job. It's a business. It's not, you know, it's not a game. And for very young children, it can be very difficult. If a kid is a little older, they have a really well-defined sense of fantasy versus reality. I grew up in a showbiz family. Everyone I knew was an actor. My mother did cartoon voices. I knew that when my mother's voice came out of the TV that it wasn't, you know, she wasn't really a talking green ball of clay. My mother did the voice for Gumby and Casper. I knew my mother wasn't a ghost. She was standing right there in the kitchen. So, you know, I knew that people went into a studio and they talked on a microphone and they made the cartoons. Some kids who were 6 and 7 years old didn't know that. Cartoons were very real. I knew they did. An actor, a bunch of actors went to a studio and they made a cartoon. So if your kid is mature and understands fantasy versus reality and has some idea what's going on and they're going to school and you make sure they stay in school, it can work. But sometimes really young children are thrown into a situation where suddenly they're on television or like the stuff that's happening with reality TV where it's not even a character, it's that child's name. And it's supposed to be them, and they're portrayed as the bratty one. It's sort of scripted, so the kid is being encouraged to say and do certain things that they're not normally saying and doing. So reality TV, there's a lot of acting going on. But when that kid goes to school, all anyone knows is it's them. They can't even say it was the character. What does that do? I was playing a character based on somebody in the 1800s, and I still had people throw stuff at me. So and I was 12, so I knew it was a character. What happens if somebody's only 6 or 7 and they're in the environment? And the publicity machine, the Hollywood machine, it's an industry. They're concerned about making money, getting the show on, the ratings, you know, publicizing, getting the actor out there as a commodity. And actors can become commodities, like a product, like a can of Coke or Pepsi. And if you're an adult and you understand that, you have your own life, your personal life, and your real life, and you have your Hollywood life where your name is a brand and a commodity, and that's okay. You can do that. What if you're 10 years old? to commodify a child, that gets really weird. And if the parent is either unscrupulous or just very naive, they can find themselves in situations where their child is being commodified and treated as someone who is not really a person, but a product at an age when they can't possibly process this. And this is where you see the disasters.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you were explaining all that, I was thinking of the, I guess, true story of the actress, and I get her name wrong. I wanted to say Melissa Gold, but the one who was in the TV show with Kirk Cameron, where they kept having a running joke through the whole show about how fat she was, and the actress herself became anorexic.
She almost died between the anorexia and the drugs and the drinking. It was awful, the poor woman.
Yeah.
I mean, and this is huge. And the commodification, it also can affect the family's relationship. I've seen this a lot, and that's why I'm doing a lot of stuff. There's a group called A Minor Consideration. It was founded by Paul Peterson, who'd been on the Donna Reed show.
Right.
There's a lot of groups now. There's a program called Looking Ahead through the Actors Fund, trying to make sure that these young kids don't fall into these disastrous situations. But you'll see kids where a family who may be very naive, not understand this Hollywood machine, come to L.A., and it becomes all about the kid's job. The parents, there are parents who literally quit their jobs, and the kid goes to work, and the whole balance of the family is thrown out, and they don't know what they've gotten themselves into. The parents go berserk, start spending money that they don't really have. They don't realize their child is still a child. There are people who will see a child, and this is something both Corey Feldman and Corey Haim talked about, and Leif Garrett talked about.
Right.
A kid is making money and famous, so suddenly they're no longer a kid. They're at parties, and people are offering them cocaine and booze and pot and drugs and whatever, and going, oh, here, like they would an adult celebrity. Well, you're famous, you're rich, would you like some cocaine? they're 10. But there are people who just decide, well, they're Drew Barrymore. Drew Barrymore, okay, she's turned out well. Drew Barrymore was going to nightclubs and drinking in bars when she was 11 and 12 years old. Why? Who was serving her? What bartender was pouring the drink? She was 11. They all knew she was 11. She couldn't even get... They were serving her at these clubs in Hollywood. She was seen out on the town with grown men, and they would say, Drew Barrymore was at blah, blah club with so-and-so. And I'm like, she's 12. He's 35. What? Are you all insane? And nobody thought, was she Drew Barrymore?
Yeah, and of course you mentioned Leif Garrett, who's claimed to fame recently as being on Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew. I mean, that's a very sad story.
And Leif Garrett, he's come to his senses. He's had some periods of really good sobriety, and one of the things he said was, hey, note to Justin Bieber, I used to own my own plane. And it's true, because, I mean, here was someone, he had his own airplane when he was like 15. He was a millionaire. He was a huge pop star, and that's gone. And he's been very ill and with the drug addiction and the terrible problems he's had. And Drew Barrymore, Drew Barrymore was sober by 14. Imagine, you hit bottom and you cleaned up by 14. What did you do before that? And that's the thing.
That's
because her family, her father wasn't around. He was, John Barrymore. He wasn't really there. And her mother didn't see her as a child. She saw her as a movie star, and so did everyone around her. So all the normal things of, hey, maybe this kid should be in school, maybe this child should be home in bed, didn't even enter their tiny little minds. And there was a lot of this, she's not a child, she's an actress. And I even heard that said about me, oh, she's not a child, she's an actress. And that's real funny until it's, oh, well, we let them not go to school anymore, and we let them drink and smoke and take drugs and go out all night because, well, they're famous. It's not the same. Yeah. And parents stop being parents, and they're busy. And what happens if the parent who says, well, if my child doesn't want to do it anymore, will say, it's okay, you can quit now. Sounds totally reasonable. But between that moment and the moment the child gets sick of it, they get a series, and they're making $150,000 a year. And they turned to their parents and said, I've decided I don't want to do this with the rest of my life. I'm going to go, I want to stay in school and become a marine biologist. I'm done. Is the parent really going to say, great, let's talk to your agent, see if we can get you out of your contract because you don't feel like it when it's $150,000 a year or more?
Right.
Okay. Two and a Half Men. The kid on Two and a Half
Men.
There you go. He quite rightly at some point went, wow, I don't like this. I'm not into this. He was tiny when he started doing that. It's one thing to say I decided to be an actor. How do you decide to be an actor when you're like the Olsen twins, when you're two? People become famous when they're two. Did you sign that contract? You didn't sign that contract. That wasn't their decision. So he was very young when he became famous. It was not his decision. And then at some point he decided he was over it and wanted to do something else. And you know what? They said, oh, well, maybe if you can have one more year, because he was making like $1 million a year. Of course they said, oh, no, honey, you're not quitting. And then that didn't go very well. Then he kind of like had a meltdown in public and it got really weird. And it was the producers who kind of said, hey, maybe we should let him out of his contract. He doesn't want to do this anymore. But that's the thing. And I've seen that again and again. And I know people who went through a lot of stuff and are grown now and are okay, but told me, yep, the day I said, great, I don't want to do this anymore, and my parents said, are you crazy? How do you think we're paying the rent? Get your ass back to work.
Somehow or another, thankfully, you managed to avoid all of that, it sounds like. How did that happen?
Well, I think in a way, although I had a crazy showbiz family, because it was a crazy showbiz family, they understood it was a job. They understood it was work and that it was a job, so there was some respect for that. They didn't think I got up in the morning and went to work and made that money by magic. They understood it was a job. They were all competing for and involved in the same kind of work, so they knew what was in it. And I think that at least treating it with that respect, that it wasn't just like, oh, I have a kid and I've rented him out and I'm now making money, realizing the kid is working, that helped. I got my own money. They had enough respect to realize that my trust fund really was my trust fund and didn't belong to other people and that I had earned the money. So they didn't steal my money.
Very fortunate.
I think that was very helpful. But
I
heard horror stories. I know people who were thrown out of the house as a teenager because they weren't making enough money.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
So, there's some real, you know, bottom-of-the-barrel scrapers there. But I think what it is parents who may not realize. So there are things you can do if you decide that your kid is going to be in Hollywood. If you go to the Screen Actors Guild, the union, they have orientation meetings where they have people come and speak and explain what you can do and better ways to work with your kid. There's all these educational programs. There's this program called Looking Ahead you can sign up for at the Actors Fund, which has – they also just have, like, parties and outings for kids who are working. But they also have access to things to help with their education and their sanity and how to manage your money. And they tell you how to set up a trust fund. So there's resources
now.
Oh,
that's good. Yeah.
They were there when I was a kid, but it's crazy.
I would imagine, too, there's a different, like, you know, there's always been tabloids and news and reporters or whatever coming around, but now there are so many more outlets. I mean, everybody's got a video in their camera, and they can make a video or say what they want about somebody or catch somebody at a bad moment.
Yep.
One thing I admired, you and Steve
mm-hmm.
Tracy, I believe, the actor that played your Nellie's husband, Percival.
Yes.
On Little House on the Prairie. You guys, when you were in the tabloids, you guys just made a game of it, I think. And like, okay, they're going to write about
it.
Yeah, we'll say we're in love.
It was a different era. If the National Enquirer had a story on you, you'd done something dumb and the Enquirer was you caught, you had like 4 days to have your publicist talk them out of it. Because it was print. Oh, my God, they had to, like, put the paper to bed on Thursday night so it could come out on Sunday. I mean, they had to go print the thing, for God's sakes. It was on paper. So there was this huge delay between the time you fell on your ass in front of the bar and the time it made the paper that your agent, your manager, your publicist could get on the phone with the Enquirer and say, look, we'll give you this other story about one of our other clients. If you drop this, come on, Joe, I'm an old friend of yours. Don't run it. You can't do that now. There's a guy with a phone for TMZ, and they've got you live feed video falling on your ass in front of the bar. There's no time to call someone and talk them out of it. So that's a very different era. But indeed, because it was a more controlled environment, if you will, of tabloidism, you could work the system. You could totally work the system. And I learned to work the system, and as did Steve. So the Enquirer would do something, and so you'd call them and go, you know, I didn't really like that article you did last week. Could you write something nice about me this week? And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, what do you got? Oh, you want us to cover something? And they would promote things you wanted. You could work with them. And there were people you could call and talk to. So in this case, with Steve and I, here he was gay, and it was the 70s, and there was no such thing as Neil Patrick Harris yet, so people didn't come out of the closet when they were on Little House in the Prairie. And I didn't go, and it was like we both needed press, and I was dating a guy who was like, I don't want to be in the paper. And can you imagine, you know, high school boys were like, what? I can't deal with this. So it's like, okay, let's go out. We're friends. We like hanging out together. People think we're dating because we go everywhere together. Let's tell them, yes, it's all true. It was great because there was already a rumor. So we said, yes, it's true. We're completely having an affair. And then that was it. It solved like 6 or 7 problems all in one fell swoop. So we did an interview with the Enquirer on Valentine's Day. So help me God. And we bought each other cards and candy. And we did a big interview with the Enquirer. And they ran this huge piece with great photos. We got to pick the photos, talking about how brilliant and talented we were and saying that we were madly in love. And therefore, now he no longer had to worry about, we could double date. I could take my boyfriend. He could bring his boyfriend and we'd go out and nobody cared. Suddenly we were both covered, and we got great. We also got invited to all the best parties because
that's right.
We were a Hollywood couple. But I don't know if you could do that now.
Because now they would know where you live, and they would go, well, no, you guys, he lives in Laurel Canyon with the blonde guy, and you live over with the other. They would, like, know. It would, like, be painfully obvious that we were having them on. Yeah.
Allison, I want to ask you, I keep telling people your book, Confessions of a Prairie Bitch, is just brilliant. And I want to ask, you were just, last month, you were doing the Agatha Christie play at Judson Theater.
I did. I'm so pleased. I read all the Agatha Christie books when I was in, like, elementary school, junior high. I belonged to one of those book clubs in school. Like, I'd say, oh, Agatha Christie, I have another Agatha Christie book. So I love that stuff. And Then There Were None is, like, her most popular. That was her bestseller. And it became a play. It's been made into a movie so many times. There's, like, so many versions of the film, and I think the BBC did a whole mini series based on it that was, like, bloodthirsty, like Game of Thrones. It's a great property. And it's been performed a lot as a play because it's a murder mystery. It's great. Everybody drops dead one by one. It's wonderful. And it's all English. It's like Downton Abbey with killing.
It rains, of course.
If you like Downton Abbey and the crime, you want to see a bunch of English people bump each other off. It's brilliant. So I went to North Carolina, and I played Emily Brent, who is this horrible old English woman. She's like the Dowager on Downton Abbey. She's very mean. And sanctimonious and religious and says terrible things to people and then dies. So it was really, really fun. And I got to actually do British Agatha Christie murder mystery. So much good.
You know, I got to say, ever since Harlan, your manager, told me about this, I was when I would start the show sometimes, or I would say who was coming up, you know, I'd say, and Allison Arngrim. And right now, she's doing this. You know, we would say, and then there were none. Agatha Christie play at the Judson Theater.
Yep.
And these guys on here, they're witnesses. They know I've been telling everybody this. But do you think, do you plan to do any more touring and with your stand-up or in a play? Because, you know, we're all out here all over the country. We want to see you.
You are. Well, you need to get the Nelly newsletter.
Okay.
You need to get the monthly Nelly newsletter. It comes to your email. If you want to, anyone who's listening, if you want to email me at Loose Gravel Productions at AOL. So it's Loose, L-O-O-S-E, Gravel, G-R-A-V-E-L, P-R-O-D, at AOL, Loose Gravel Prod. We'll put you on my mailing list right away. I'll send you the latest one myself.
Okay.
And it gives you a list of everything that I'm currently doing and where I'm going to be. Right now, okay, I just did North Carolina. So this weekend, I'm doing my tour. I do a tour of Hollywood. Because, you know, we're talking about all these people I know, like, who work for Betty Davis. And so I have a tour of Hollywood, the Nasty Nelly Tour of Hollywood, where a tour guide friend of mine and I go around in a little van. It's like only 12 people. And we go to Michael Landon's house, and we go to Liberace's house, and we go to the Chateau Marmont, and we go to all these Hollywood landmarks. But I live there, or I know the person who lives there. I have personalized stories about all these Hollywood places.
Oh,
so we do that
on
Sunday.
Just a and that's on the weekends in L.A.? Oh,
that's Sunday, yeah.
All right, Kenya?
Yes?
It's been a while since our last trip. Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I'm thinking what you're thinking, honey.
You do. You need to come out here. You need to take my tour.
On the road
totally
again.
Do.
On the road that's, again. Sounds good
to
me.
We haven't been on a trip since Book Expo America last year in Chicago. I think it's time for you and I need a trip. We need a trip again. Yeah. Rick, you can come along,
right?
Too. You and your wife can come along too, but that would be even
more. Sounds wonderful.
Also, I'm supposed to get
sounds
you a
wonderful.
Hello. I've had some messages.
And then next week I'm going to Palm Springs.
Oh,
I like Palm Springs.
You're getting closer to my home.
Right, I'm going down to Palm Springs, and they're having a whole. There's a place that it's the Rat Pack Hideaway. It's this hotel where, you know.
I'll do what I can.
Dino and Jerry and everybody used to hang out. And so I'm going down there. They're doing a show, and I'm part of that. And then I'm going to the Missouri. I'll be in Missouri. That's the Marshfield, Missouri Cherry Blossom Festival.
Ridiculous. You expect me to do this in 2 days?
And then I'm going to Seattle. I'll be up in the Northwest. I'll be in Seattle at the Port Orchard Film Festival. And then I'm in New York. Who's in New York? I'm in New York Mother's Day weekend. I'm at the Laurie Beachman Theater Saturday night and Sunday afternoon.
Okay, so look at that in the Nelly newsletter. And on all my social media, folks, you know, I have Twitter and Reddit and tumblers, everything in the world. I will put this on everything that Jennifer Perry and Madam Perry have on social media so that everybody can get on the Nelly newsletter. Get that coming to your email. You know what's going on.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, I'm kind of sitting here like, I got to pull up. Here it is. There's your J. Perry. Okay, I found your email. This is good. So I can send you the newsletter here because they'll send you the current one and you can see everything I'm doing. Yeah, so I'm in New York, and then after New York, I'm in Nebraska, and then I'm in South Dakota. I am doing the entire country.
Okay, fantastic. And I'm also supposed to give you a hello from a dear friend of mine in Kenya. His name is Colin Kelly, and he interviewed you, I think he said, about 2 years ago for Atlanta.
Oh,
and
great, great.
And he wanted to be on here tonight, but he said he sent me a text. He had to cover a meeting at the last minute, but he's a dear friend of ours, and he just wanted to say hello, and he just thinks you're fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
And so, listen, I could keep you forever. Oh, can I tell you this? This is a comment because I got Kenya drinking coffee a few years ago, and I'm sure we're drinking a lot of coffee. This is, I know I got to let you go. You've been very generous with your time, but you have you are so funny, but you have so many comments that I was taking notes on in the book, like calling the makeup and hair department at Little House on the Prairie was a DMZ. I like that. And then
you're right. It was. Oh, my God. Yeah.
When you were talking about coffee, this bit, would you please, you're going to say it much better than I do. You were talking about the different kinds of coffee, the coffee that Grips made.
Yeah.
And
It's true. I always say what I call grip strength. There's different strengths of coffee. There's grip strength, AA strength, French strength, because the French obviously make coffee that, you know, peels paints off of the wall. It's like espresso, but that's their coffee. But then there's, if you've ever been to a 12-step meeting, and it was an AA, will tell you they make the strongest coffee in the world. You can like chew it. But then there's grip strength, because on sets, the crew makes this lethal coffee because they've got to, you know, start work at like 4 a.m. and got to keep going all day. And so when I first started drinking coffee, I started drinking the strongest coffee in the world because it was what was grip strength. And so that's when I got to France, I was like, no, this is nothing, man. I've had grip strength.
I've had the best of the best, the strongest of the strongest.
Let you put it again. There's normal. There's AA.
I'm sending you a copy of the most recent newsletter right now because it's got Nelly's Easter Tour, Palm Springs, all kinds of great stuff that's happening here.
That's great. So then you said by the time you got through drinking that and got hair and makeup, you said I went out, I was painted, petticoated, and fully caffeinated.
Exactly. Which you needed to be, man.
He's
on two calls at once. This is like hilarious.
I think
Port Orchard. Port Orchard's up there in Washington. And then is New York. Is May 13th and 14th in New York. Then it's Ocomic-Con it's Council Bluffs, Iowa at Ocomic-Con. And then I'm in DeSmet, South Dakota. And then I go back to France in September. So, yeah, just keep checking for me on my website at bonnetheads.com. Check my Facebook, check my newsletter, and you can see where I am.
All right. So cute. Love it.
Thank you so very much. You have just been so generous with your time. I kept you too long, I know. And so, everyone, please get the book. Confessions of a Prairie Bitch. You'll thank me and you'll thank Allison for writing it. I'll also have all the information on how on getting on the Nelly newsletter. And give us the name of that website again.
Bonnetheads.com. BONNETHEADS for all you Little House fans who are such little bonnet heads. Bonnetheads.com, where you can read about everything I'm doing.
I am a bonnet head. That is so
you are.
Cool.
Wear your bonnet with pride. I say bonnet head pride. Hold your head up.
Yes, ma'am. Okay. So nice to meet you.
And thank you once again to everybody for
listening
to Madam Perry Salon. And thanks to Kenya Colbert, Carrie Dunn, Colin Kelly, who am I leaving out? Rick Cornell. Vincent Levy Bryant for joining us in here in the Genie's Bottle, and most of all, to the fabulous Allison Arngrim. Allison, I'm going to leave you with my motto, everybody's got to swing, and thank you so much, and please come back sometime.